Hello, you are listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. For KVNF News, my name is Eric Gould. Thanks so much for joining us. On this edition of Local Motion, as we sometimes do on the show, we'll have a buffet of radio items for you to listen to. First, we'll have our last interview with KVNF's own Felix Belmont. The 101-year-old DJ stepped down from the microphone and completed his last stop time show on November 10th. And then, along with fellow Sunday DJ Dennis Grunkmeyer, completed their last flight of fancy last Sunday on November 17th. Felix will tell us about his first days doing music and news for KVNF. And after that, here on Local Motion, we'll have a couple of stories from the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange dealing with regional agricultural issues. That's all on Local Motion here at KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. First, let's hear from Felix Belmont. As we celebrated during our fall pledge drive, KVNF sent out its first broadcast signal to the Western Slope on October 5th, 1979. As Felix likes to point out, he was a member of KVNF since before we were even on the air.
Well, I actually joined KVNF, not as a DJ, but as a member, about a week before that. And then shortly after that, I got DJ training. And because the studio up on Garvin Mesa at that time was already set up, and there was a very lovely young lady who was one of the original people with Campbell Stanton, and she somehow got the nickname of Susie Cream Cheese. I don't know how that came about, but Susie Cream Cheese said, "I'll teach you how to be a DJ." And in those days, all we had was 33 and a third records. This is long before compact disc came out. And she took me up to the studio and spent a couple of days showing me how to put a record on and cue it up and so on. And then Patrick Webb said, "Why don't you do a show tunes program?" And so I started doing a weekly program of movie soundtracks and stuff from Broadway. And somehow that morphed into Stop Time at a later date. And I did Stop Time up until... what was it? I did my last one last Sunday.
That was Felix Belmont telling KVNF News about his first days as a working DJ here at KVNF, a little over 40 years ago. After getting his training from one of the station's original DJs, Felix's show evolved into Stop Time, highlighting songs from the big band era of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. In the early days of the station, Felix and his wife Pauline set the tone for the kind of programming that would follow on Sundays for the next 40 years. Here's Felix describing the scene.
My late wife was very concerned that in the beginning there was no classical music on KVNF, and she said, "Why don't they do some classical music?" Well, the then powers that be who were... you'll forgive me if I say we're actually kids then. They were in their 20s, because I was 60 years old when I first joined KVNF, because I had just retired from my life work in New York with the Borden Company. Anyway, she started a classical program and did the classical music from 6 to 9, I believe it was, a three-hour program on Sunday evenings.
Well, tell me about Stop Time. I know you like to have Glenn Miller starts things off for you often on your show. And that era of music, 30s, 40s, 50s, why do you think it has such a large appeal to the KVNF audience?
For one thing, it's good music as popular music. And you don't hear much of it anymore. However, recently, as Dennis, Captain Dennis, has shown... Captain Dennis alternates with me with Flight of Fancy, a lot of the current popular artists are doing some of that old music, new editions of it, and so on. My interest in it, or one of my little interests, or one of, let's say, one of my direct connections with it, was that Glenn Miller and his orchestra played for my college senior prom in 1940. This was when Glenn Miller was becoming known, but he wasn't famous as he became more famous later on. But he actually played live. He was taking gigs just like, you know, assignments, just like any other big orchestra. And my senior class, I don't know where how we ever got the money to pay him, but we had him as a live orchestra for our senior prom. And that was at my college, Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, in May 1940, yeah. That was my one live connection with big bands. I've always liked Glenn Miller. I've always liked Tommy Dorsey and that music. And that was the music that I grew up with.
And here's a clip of the last Stop Time show Felix did on November 10th, along with the introduction featuring the program's theme song, performed by Glenn Miller.
It is now 12:01, and stay with us for Stop Time. Well, good afternoon. It's 12:02, and welcome to another edition of Stop Time. I'm Felix Belmont, and as usual, we started off here with Glenn Miller in the mood, and we'll go on now to a little more Glenn Miller.
Stop Time became one of KVNF's signature shows, and soon it was joined on Sundays by Flight of Fancy. Longtime member, DJ, and volunteer at KVNF, Dennis Grunkmeyer, alternated with Felix on the Sunday afternoon time slot. Captain Dennis, as he was known on the show, drew off of his personal experiences in life to create the show and its character. Here's Felix talking about that.
Let me just explain, if people don't happen to know, the reason we call him Captain Dennis, and he calls it Flight of Fancy, and he, over the air, he pretends that he takes off and lands and everything. He actually is a graduate of the Air Force Academy and served in the Air Force for a number of years. He served in Vietnam and so on, and then he joined Delta Airlines and rose to be a senior, finally retired from Delta Airlines as a senior captain. So when he says, sit down and buckle your seatbelts, all he's doing is just saying what he said as a captain. But that little spiel that he gives and you hear the plane taking off and landing is actually for real. Because as I said, he was a graduate of the Air Force Academy some years ago and served in the Air Force, flying the big bombers for many years, and he was in Vietnam and so on, and until he joined Delta Airlines, and then flew for Delta Airlines for a number of years. So he is a genuine captain, believe me. We both decided to retire. He hadn't done as many years with KVNF as I had, but he said, I've had enough too. Can I just say that I can't express how grateful I am to the incredible support that I've had and Dennis has had with your support of Stop Time and Flight of Fancy, but I want to express my own personal, it's more than gratitude, it's been incredible the support I've had and Dennis has had from all you listeners in tuning in on Sundays to hear Stop Time and Flight of Fancy. And I have every confidence that whatever is going to follow at that 3-hour slot on Sunday will be something that you will like and will be worthwhile listening to. And hopefully we can continue to have your continued great support.
That was KVNF DJ Felix Belmont expressing his thanks for his many listeners over the course of his 40-year career on the microphone. If you're just joining us here on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, you are listening to Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. We have been hearing from now-retired KVNF DJ Felix Belmont in his last interview with KVNF News, talking about the evolution of his show Stop Time and the Sunday programs on KVNF. Felix and fellow longtime DJ Dennis Grunkmeyer retired and did their last show on November 17th. As well as being a well-known DJ, Felix Belmont worked as host of the Delta County Commissioner's Report since 1993. The monthly conversation featured Felix interviewing one of the three Delta County commissioners, as well as other county government officials, to talk about the state of county business and local affairs. Here's Felix talking about the show and its influence.
Yes, I enjoyed very much meeting the commissioners every month, meeting one of the commissioners every month and talking about current things. I think that the commissioners have always supported KVNF very much so, and I think they appreciated having this show, that show, and it gave them some exposure. And I think most of them liked doing it. They didn't always like having to haul all the way up here to Peonia, but they did. We enjoyed a great rapport with the county commissioners. And personally, I was very sorry to see it end. I have been told, now I don't know if this is true or not, and I've never seen anything in writing, but I've been told that in the job description that the county has for a county commissioner, there's a couple of lines that says something to the effect that once a month, one of you will go up to KVNF and be on the radio. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I've been told that that is in their job description for new county commissioners coming on board. Actually, it was a one-hour show for a long time, and then we cut it back to a 30-minute show. And I always felt that the 30-minute show was a tighter, better show than the one-hour show, because to come up with questions and comments and everything for a full hour was milking it. You know, it was a little difficult. The 30-minute show, which we've had for I don't know how many years now, the last 5, 10 years, whatever, was a much better, tighter show, frankly. And I think everybody thought it was better, and it was easier to do, it was better, and 30 minutes of talking is enough, you know, at one time.
Over the many years, Felix became known as the world's oldest working DJ. While such a thing is probably impossible to prove, Felix is a rare human being who had a very distinctive radio personality. KVNF News asked Felix what he feels about that nickname, the world's oldest working DJ. And he explained what he learned over the years as a radio personality.
I think that's probably exaggerated. I will say this. I'm the oldest DJ in KVNF, and conceivably I am the oldest DJ in public radio in the country. As some of you know, I'm 101 years old, so I'm older than a lot of other people, that's for sure. I would not say the oldest DJ in the world or something like that. That's we don't know. But for around here, I'm the oldest DJ, that's for sure. I think I have learned humility, if anything. And I think I've learned that people expect and enjoy and will, by and large, support good programming on public radio. And if you give them something that they can enjoy and they can count on and is worth listening to, they'll support it. As for myself, I can say the only adjective, whatever it is, that I can think of is humility, as far as I'm concerned, and deep gratitude.
That was Felix Belmont here on Local Motion in his final interview with KVNF News. Stop Time and his news presence will definitely be missed. Felix left a legacy of music and community radio that will always be here at KVNF. And stay tuned for special Felix appearances in the future, when he'll return to help with fundraisers and other KVNF projects. I'm Eric Gould with KVNF News, and you are listening to Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. Now here on the show, we're going to shift gears a little bit and hear a couple of stories from the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange. Hemp is taking the Colorado agriculture industry by storm and gaining a reputation as a highly valuable, supposedly drought-tolerant cash crop. But is the plant really as ideal for a state facing severe water scarcity as it's being made out to be? Or is the outside-the-box thinking hemp is inspiring really behind hemp's water needs and viability in the West? As part of our ongoing Connecting the Drops series for the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange, KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers spoke with researchers and visited multiple hemp grows in northeast Colorado.
Hemp, the non-psychoactive form of cannabis, has a complicated history in the U.S. Many of the founding fathers grew hemp and praised the plant as a cash crop. Then, in 1937, a tax law essentially made the plant illegal. During World War II, the U.S. government changed the rules again, begging farmers to grow hemp.
In 1942, 14,000 acres of fiber hemp were harvested in the United States. The goal for 1943 is 300,000 acres. Thus, hemp, cannabis sativa, is staging a strong comeback.
And now, after decades of redesignation as an illegal controlled substance, Colorado farmers are leading the way in yet another major hemp comeback, with the plant's high value and possible drought tolerance taking center stage.
There is sort of a gold rush craze right now for it.
However, researchers like Katie Russell, manager of Colorado State University's Southwestern Colorado Research Center, one of multiple groups doing extensive study on hemp's drought tolerance, say hemp may be getting more credit for tolerating dry conditions than it currently deserves.
I don't think this is a dry land crop for our area because we do have such low rainfall and it's very variable among seasons. So it could be very risky some years and it could work out other years. It's probably on point with corn. If you looked at a perennial system, alfalfa, for instance, it would be a water savings in comparison.
Part of the problem is very little research on hemp exists, considering the plant was mostly off limits to farmers and scientists until the passage of the 2014 and 2018 farm bills. But now, researchers like Russell are free to look into ways to help boost the plant's value and hardiness.
I think we could really improve hemp as a drought crop. I think as we move forward in the future, if we're really targeting that as a specific breeding purpose, then I think that we could find it could work in a lot of more arid environments.
CBD, an oil extracted from hemp flowers, is used in a wide variety of popular products, marketed for calming, healing, and health. Hemp fibers in the plant's stock are used in items like clothing, rope, and paper. Russell says regardless of the end use, hemp farmers may be less likely to minimize hemp's water consumption when they see how much better the plant performs with more water.
We're seeing larger growth habit with the higher water, greater stem diameter, more branches, which would likely then be more flowers and should equal more yield. If this were a fiber system, something that really relies on high biomass, I think you'd see a pretty good yield reduction under the lower water use scenario.
So the variety of hemp plants currently available may not deserve the title of drought tolerant on their own, but it does appear the hemp boom is inspiring a new wave of creativity in agriculture with a focus on saving water. Jason von Limke, director of the Subsurface Irrigation Efficiency Project, or SEEP, says the hype around hemp is pulling water-saving irrigation techniques out of the shadows and into the mainstream spotlight.
One of the cool things about it is it does draw younger people in who are kind of open to these technologies and things like that. So if anything, you might see a jump in more people using efficient irrigation.
And studying water efficiency in agriculture is exactly what von Lemke and the SEEP team do at their research facility in Kersey, Colorado, where the primary focus is 82 acres of subsurface drip irrigation. This is a system rarely used in Colorado that pumps water from a well through a filtration system that can add nutrients to the water before delivering it directly to the roots of the rows of plants planted on mounds.
If you are irrigating in flood irrigation, your crop is absorbing about 45% of that water, right? And the other 55% of that water is runoff or it evaporates, etc. If you're using a pivot circle, your efficiency is around 80%. And so what we're trying to do with drip irrigation is get those efficiencies up to 95, 98%.
SEEP researchers are growing hemp because it does well with subsurface drip irrigation, and its value makes the high cost of switching to the water-efficient drip system more feasible.
The system is expensive. It costs about $1,500 to $1,750 an acre to install. We have been growing alfalfa here for the last like 3 or 4 seasons. And the return on the investment on alfalfa, which prior to hemp was what we believed one of the most valuable cash crops, because you can get about $130 to $150 a ton for that. Compare that to hemp, we can sell our hemp flour at $35 a pound.
SEEP is studying other less expensive non-traditional forms of irrigation that also work well with hemp.
This is our mobile drip system.
This more accessible water-saving design uses a traditional pivot irrigation system, the type you see on most farmland, working its way across the field, watering the crops from above. But this one has hoses or drip lines attached to each nozzle, delivering water directly to the ground around the plants as it moves.
I'm so excited about this. I think this is one of the immediate answers.
An hour and a half away in Sterling, Colorado, the Lebsock Hemp Farm is testing irrigating hemp with drip on a major scale.
The hemp business, huh?
Raised beds, plastic, drip, all underneath, all no evaporation, no what have you. Go ahead, walk through there.
That's David Lebsock. His family is growing 1,000 acres of hemp for CBD. The entire crop is irrigated on a subsurface drip system. They're hoping drip will save them 40 to 50% of their water. Another benefit to drip irrigation is it allows Lebsock to use more of his land.
See where the pivot actually ends right there?
Mm-hmm.
All that from there to this way was non-irrigated, but now we're able to use it as production.
And you still feel like you're hopefully, from what you're expecting, going to be using less water, even though you're using
Absolutely.
More of your space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. More space, less water. I mean, right now we haven't watered for the last week. Does that plant look like it's droughty?
Not at all.
Not at all.
With some farmers confident in hemp's water-saving value, and others unsure the plant's current drought tolerance isn't being oversold, all parties are anxiously awaiting the new data and irrigation-related discoveries uncovered with each hemp harvest. Discoveries that are undoubtedly changing the Colorado agriculture industry as a whole. For Connecting the Drops and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Hanley Myers.
Connecting the Drops is a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations and Water Education Colorado. Find out more at watereducationcolorado.org. Support is provided by CoBank, which provides financing solutions for rural water systems. Find out more at cobank.com.
And finally, here on Local Motion, it took years of careful persistence from Moab-based experts and residents, but Utah's Water Quality Board is now changing state rules on gray water. Soon, property owners could see more options and less cost when it comes to reusing their shower and laundry water for outside landscaping. For the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange, KZMU's Molly Marcello has the story.
Hello. Hello.
How are you?
Hi.
It's a bright November morning when staff and board members from Utah's Water and Environmental Quality Departments begin gathering in a Moab garden. It's a small space, about 200 square feet, but full of fruit trees and native plants.
I brought a shovel around if anyone wants to check out how beautifully rich the soil is. They can feel free to do so.
Dr. Rosalind Brain McCann, sustainability professor at Utah State University in Moab. In an arid climate, the rich soil of her front yard garden is notable. But it's not her garden's soil that's brought state regulators to her front yard. It's how she waters it, with a shower and a load of laundry.
This system is entirely gray water fed, and it's been a fun experiment to see what's working, what to shift, what to tweak.
Back in 2016, at the urging of Brain McCann and others in Moab, state regulators issued her front yard an experimental permit for a simple gravity-fed gray water system. Utah health and wastewater experts have now studied her garden for 4 years as they consider changes to the state's gray water code.
When the policy doesn't make sense to me, it's not the end of the road to me. It's like, let's change the policy, let's make this happen and make it right.
Utah's longstanding rule on gray water is a far leap from the simple system developed in Moab. That rule requires a 250-gallon holding tank, a pumping system, and filter. Health officials say not one Utah property owner has ever taken advantage of it. In comparison, the simple gray water design uses gravity to lead shower and laundry water to mulch basins that nourish plants under the surface. It requires little more than a $50 valve at the time of home construction. That valve can easily be turned to direct gray water to the garden or to the wastewater treatment plant.
Right now, we're in November, and it's been at least, and this is a very conservative estimate, 2 months since we've had any precip here in Moab. So to have a system where our water that would normally go to a wastewater treatment plant is actually providing the water needs of my landscape, it's, to me, a no-brainer when it comes to climate change.
Climate change concerns in the desert, combined with creative problem-solving, drove Moab's demand for a more functional state gray water rule. This, according to Southeast Utah Environmental Health Director Orion Rogers.
I think it's just due to the extensive growth that we're seeing, as well as the influx of new thought processes and an overall interest in these sort of systems, as well as the environment that we live in, essentially demanding water conservation.
But even as the state makes big moves to legalize this system, local health departments and districts would not be required to opt in. Rogers, however, feels confident that Moab can be the example for the rest of the state.
As we start showing how this works in Moab, I think that other health departments are going to come on board, and as we have developments come along that are using gray water, we can show the world that this works.
The new gray water rule is out now for public comment. In a few months, if the Water Quality Board finds no significant changes to be made, these simple gray water systems will officially become legal in Utah.
There are a lot of potential gray water systems ready to be turned on as a result of this rule.
Moab City Mayor Emily Niehaus is on the Utah Water Quality Board. She says having a better way to reuse water is not just beneficial for Moab's arid desert, but also for the entire state.
You know, a state where desertification and lack of water and huge expected growth, we have to be taking these measures. And so while it's important for us in Moab to change the law to, you know, help us do what we want to do locally, it's also very exciting to know that other people in other counties, in other parts of Utah are going to benefit from this too.
Reporting from Moab, Utah, I'm Molly Marcello.
And that was your weekly edition of Local Motion here on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.